Welcome to the Nottingham Business School Business Leaders Podcast, where business leaders tell their stories and share their insights. All our guests have a personal connection with Nottingham Business School. So listen, learn, enjoy, and share.
Welcome to another episode of the Business Leaders Podcast with me, Mike Sassy. Jonathan Suckling and Gary Julian graduated from Nottingham Trent in 1994. More than 30 years later, they're both at the top of their trade. Jonathan is a director and member of the exec team at construction giant Vulcan Vessels UK, while Gary is commercial MD at construction engineer T. Clark Contracting. During the last three decades, they have both enjoyed stellar careers in the British and European construction industries. They've used the skills they learned and the contacts they first made at Trent to help build careers as respected leaders. Today, they're back in Nottingham to pass on their expertise to future generations and to share a few insights with us on this special episode of the Business Leaders Podcast. So, Jonathan and Gary, you are very welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
So, Jonathan first, maybe, how is it back to be in Nottingham?
Yeah, great to be back in Nottingham. Brings a lot of memories back from walking past Rock City to seeing the development that's been had in this area. And a lot of fond memories from that time.
Good
30,
stuff.
35 years ago.
35, oh Lord.
When we started.
It's looking better than it was then?
Looking a lot better.
Looking a lot better. Okay, Gary, what do you think?
Yeah, it's been a while. I must say, Newton looks really impressive.
That's the Narcrag building, the business HQ.
That was nothing like, it's nothing like what it was now, back then. I remember a lot of shops down here and we were just reminiscing about our favourite sandwich shop called Eddie's. We used to get the bacon and sausage back with tomato and used to come out of this building, Chaucer, and go there. For your breakfast.
So it's all, Nero's and Costa and a slightly more upmarket?
Nero's and Costa didn't really exist. The Cafe Society really established back then.
Okay. Let's move on. But anyway, you came through the same course, quantity surveying, at the same university, obviously this one, Nottingham Trent, and at the same time, class of 94. So, three decades on, with a lot of shared DNA, how has that helped shape your careers?
Crikey. So the course we did was a four-year sandwich in quantity surveying. So I think the first thing that shaped our career was that sandwich year out, where you could actually put into practice what you'd learned during the first 2 years. And it's good to see that's still going on today. I'd say, three decades on, Nottingham Trent has got a good reputation. It's why we came here in the first place. And you meet your peers across other businesses. There's usually a commonality that probably half the people you meet in the quantity surveying world have an association with Nottingham Trent. So that's really good in terms of breaking the ice, forming relationships. And there's a commonality in the background that people have. That's my initial take on it.
Okay, Gary, the shared DNA?
Yeah, I mean, the surveying school back then, and I think it still is probably one of the most well-known, recognised and well-regarded courses in the country. I think when we graduated, there was 84 students on the course. I'm not sure how many will actually be practising surveyors now, but it's the qualification you get is highly portable. And that's not just in the UK. When I graduated in 94, I was quite fortunate to go out to Hong Kong. And when I was in Hong Kong, I remember bumping into three of my fellow graduates who are working out there for international organisations. So it provided a lot of us with a good baseline stepping stone into work.
So at that time, did you realise the importance of your peer group, that you were sort of building a professional network that is going to, last you for the whole of your career?
No, it didn't register at the time. I think you reflect as you get older and realise that it all roads lead back. So at the time, you're when you start out, you're just busy just trying to establish yourself, whether that be in whatever organization it is you're contracting, professional consultancy, etc. But you meet people along the way, and sometimes you do come across people who studied at Nottingham, not necessarily in our 94
sure.
graduation year, but others that have been through it, and then you reminisce, and then you talk about Nottingham, and so like what you did, the Gooseberry Bush, the Arboretum, Rock City, you know, what nightclubs you went to. I mean, there was one for every night of the week, I believe, other than Saturday. And it's just shared times, and it does open conversation, which is, you know, opening the conversation, is there's a skill to it. If it's an icebreaker, that always helps.
Yeah. So. Did you realise, Jonathan, you know, as I say, I don't know whether 18, 19, 20, 21-year-olds realise what they're setting themselves up for the next 30 years.
I think you're too young to really understand that importance. And do you really listen to everyone that tells you that at the time? So that would be a reflection. I think the importance of the peer group for me was, you know, you build your friendship groups, you come out into industry. And for us, there was about five of us that were quite close and maintained good contact for a number of years. And three of us still see each other regularly. You know, families and kids have all grown up with each other. But those early years, you've got a support network out of your particular job. So it's very important that you've got someone to talk about how you're doing and understanding how they're progressing and what experience they're getting. It's also some healthy competition at the younger years that you can use to bounce off each other. And, you know, we're all team players. We like to win. So that was healthy. And then it gets to a point where everyone sort of settled down and it's, you know, you gave your families and other things are more important.
Yeah, I remember the first five or six years, like amateur one. Really? All right. Okay.
Well, that's interesting you say, because I was going to ask you about that flip side. You know, has your friendship ever created challenges? You know, when you've been competing for business, because it's all, you know, support network. That's great, love it. And I guess you're always talking shop for the next 30 years. But is it, you know, that competitive thing? Does it ever pull in opposite directions?
Well, we do work in different parts of the industry. Jonathan's more in civil engineering. I'm more in the commercial private sector side. So it has crossed paths. I actually did work for Jonathan 20 years ago, 15 years ago as a consultant. My own view on this is you need to be wary of crossing that dividing line between friendship and work. It's, if you're not careful, you could talk shop all the time, and you need to be able to divorce the two. Friendship and work, It can help, but my advice would be to try and divorce the two.
Oh, so keep arm's length, is that right?
Look, every situation is different. There was a time when it suited both Gary and my business that he worked for us. What was really important, day one, we said, right, this won't impact our friendship.
Right.
But we also put some barriers in place, so there wasn't that day-to-day direct contact. There was then, the only other real touch point was when Gary worked on one of the projects as a M&E subcontractor on a particular project in London.
You're going to explain M&E?
Mechanical and engineering.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Electrical engineering.
Subcontractor. So, you know, sometimes the good jobs, sometimes the bad jobs. This was probably a bit in the middle, had its moments.
It was a challenging job.
A challenging job. Okay.
But again, it was... probably Gary and I, as we have done throughout our careers, were the sort of voice of reason. So we let the MDs and the operational directors fight it out and get emotional. We just deal with facts, evidence, contract, but then a high degree of pragmatism. So we got through it, but we've kept business and
we've not worked
friendship
together since.
Right, okay. But something you just touched on there, you said you started talking about projects. So off the top of your head, give me your biggest, your best, your most high profile headline project you've worked on.
Crikey! Well, I think the biggest one's got to be Lot C1 of High Speed 2.
Oh yeah.
So this is one of the seven packages for the new High Speed.
Geographically, where is that?
It is, it starts in Colne Valley. It's 3.5 kilometre viaduct over a sort of reservoir of natural beauty. And then it dives into the tunnel around junction 17 of the M25. And then you've got 17 kilometres Twymbore tunnel northwards until we pass on to another contractor. So that's a joint venture between Volker Fitzpatrick, Sir Robert McAlpine, and Bouygues, big French company.
Okay, and how long?
$3 billion, roughly.
Okay, how long have you been on that one?
We started bidding it around, cool, take me back now, but around, say, 2016. And then there was a period of
uncertainty.
Uncertainty. But then when they chose their preferred bidders for the lots, there was probably an 18-month, two-year period in preparing and doing that stage one exercise to lock down the scope, the program, the price, the risk profile, etc., until we finally started building probably around 2019.
So 2016 bidding, 2019 start building.
Yeah.
When you finish?
Almost finished.
Almost finished.
Almost finished. Right. So I think we're a bit ahead of the pack. So we'll be finished next year, which is great. Pretty much on program.
Good stuff. Gary, any big projects?
I've been fortunate enough to work or be involved in most of the prestigious major high-rise buildings in the City of London. So I've worked on the Shard. When that came up out of the ground, we did all the mechanical pipework services installation on that back in 2009 to 2011.
And you're now based in the Shard, are you?
No, we're based in the Gherkin.
Oh, the Gherkin. Sorry, I'm getting my Shards and Gherkins mixed up.
Yeah. So, from where I'm based, I can see quite a number of tall buildings, 22 Bishop's Gate, which we did 6-7 years ago. That was the biggest project we'd been on involved in with likes of Multiplex and Lipton Rogers, who were the developer. That was a very challenging job in the centre of London. Right. So, but yeah, we tend to get involved in a lot of the large high-rise.
So do you spend your time walking past buildings and saying, "Hey, I built that"?
Yeah, I would say. I could probably, if put to the test, name pretty much every project I've worked on in my whole career, and I could probably tell you how much they made and how much.
What's that an indication of, the fact that they were all so big, or the fact that you?
No, not really. I mean, you could
live and breathe it.
Live and breathe it. So, yeah. I mean, I started work when I graduated here from '94. I worked for a company called Amy Construction, and we did road building.
Right.
So, and the first job I worked on was the Junction 5-7. Upgrade of the M40, where it goes through the pass near Tame and Stoke-on-Church. So, and that was a fantastic job to work on. So I've still got fond memories of it now.
I've interviewed a number of construction leaders on this pod, and they all enthuse about the things that they were involved with. As I say, they must have jumped in with 2 feet. Yeah. But your industry, pretty much like all industries, is changing rapidly, usually driven by AI, other aspects of tech. Sitting where you do now, what would you say is the most important skill? Now, this can be a tech skill or a leadership skill that you believe somebody, say, like, I don't know, a young surveyor will need to get on in the next decade.
There's no doubt, you know, technology, AI, it's here to stay. You've got to embrace it. I don't think there's one single thing necessarily. I think you need to be open to using all the technology that's available to you to maximise the efficiency and effectiveness of your job.
I think, to jump in there, I think AI and the technology is too early to tell how it's going to shape the industry. It's quite embryonic. A lot of people are talking about it. A lot of people have got steering groups within their organisations. Some people are more worried about it than others. So in our industry, you're at the coal face. You're going to build stuff. You're going to dig a hole. You're going to fill it with something, or you're going to build something out of it. Where it is going to change significantly is in the professional services with the design, BIM modeling, and what comes from that. And it'd be interesting to see how the learning, the machine learning that comes from that, and how it teaches people. And it, I mean, we've got this catchphrase in our organization where we're just going to try and get rid of the dross so it makes people more efficient. What that dross looks like and what we get rid of is not understood yet.
Okay, but if you're a young surveyor coming in, how, you know, and you're thinking, right, what do I do now to prepare myself? What would you say?
So what I was going to lead on to was tech's great, but unless you understand how you apply it, what the benefits are, but also what you do without that tech. So my concern is that there's an over-reliance on technology, and what you feed into the computer, it's only as good as what you put in as what you get out. So it's about actually being able to make decisions that uses tech as part of that, but not only that. And you've got to use your wider experience and your knowledge of the what you're applying it to make that final call. And that's the thing that I would say to young people is embrace it, use it, but don't rely on it. So as an example, and this is a really minor example, but we're currently recruiting for our next year of ITPs, and all of the CVs now all look the same because people have just put details in Copilot. Yeah. And my advice would be, if you want to make the difference, stand out, don't rely on that. Be creative, be yourself. That will come through for your future employee.
Can I echo that? I reviewed about 35 CVs last year, and you could spot the ones that are AI generated. And I was chuckling to myself because I'd love to get them in for interview and ask them, what do you actually mean by that? Do you actually understand what that means?
Yeah.
Because the age that they're, some of the syntax and the words they're using, so like, you wouldn't expect that from someone in their part starting their career out.
I completely get that. But you just talked about a number 35. So you to 35 and you read them on. I can see how you might read 35. I had somebody in here sitting around the table who said it was up on LinkedIn for one day and I had 600. And so what does she do? She said, well, I said, what did you do with 600? And she said, well, I had to get somebody else to read them all. In fact, 10 of us had to read them all. How are you getting around that kind of issue?
Well, I know a lot of big companies, recruiters, are using AI to try and sift that out. And
so that, right, so you're doing with that. Oh, and then aren't you into an issue there with, you know, what do you put into AI to ask what you're looking for?
Losing the personal touch. And I mean, Jonathan will have an idea of who he wants to recruit, and I've definitely got an idea of what I want to recruit. And face-to-face interviews and just actually seeing how that individual behaves when asked questions, there's no substitute for it.
Okay, but the overarching thing is be yourself, be an individual, don't be authentic.
Absolutely, absolutely. That make the difference when you get to interview, and actually on paper, you know, you need a CV that stands out. 15 years ago, we decided we were going to start taking students from Nottingham Trent and bring them in through ITPs and then graduates.
ITPs.
Industrial training placement students, so for their sandwich year. And what that developed over a number of years is the relationship with the university. So instead of having, you know, hundreds of CVs, we would do the career fair here and we would see people face to face. So rely on not just the CV, but that 10-minute almost sort of dating interview to understand, you know, if they got that little bit of magic dust.
So now we're going to take a quick break from our chat to mention the MBA programs at Nottingham Business School. As we've learned from many of our guests, effective business leadership is about confidence, adaptability, and thinking strategically. These are the key ingredients to delivering innovation and impact in crowded, competitive markets. So if you are ready to transform your career, visit ntu.ac.uk/MBA. to explore the MBA programmes at Nottingham Business School. We're one of only 1% of business schools worldwide who hold the prestigious Triple Crown accreditation. That's ntu.ac.uk/MBA to find out more. Now back to the show. You're senior leaders within UK construction, so you will have the inside track or the inside view, as it were. So what are the big issues for you and the industry that, you know, we might not hear about in the news or we might not see in the trade press?
For me, the simplest answer is certainty. So it's certainty of the future workload. It's the fact that when, especially the public sector, when they bid, when they ask for people to bid for their work, that that scheme does have the right funding. It is going to go ahead, because the worst thing is to spend lots of money on bidding for projects that then get shelved. That's wasted money. That's an overhead that we need to recover.
And are you seeing that increasingly? Or
yeah, because and it always increases at certain cycles. So at the moment, you know, people are waiting to see what happens in the budget. When there's an election, people stall for sort of 6 to 9 months until they see the outcome of the election. What we need is we need a more coherent infrastructure plan that looks at the long-term future of what needs to be done, and then everyone get behind that. So, you know, the certainty of projects, coupled with there is a skill shortage. You know, I think Brexit has been part of that, but also, you know, is construction seen as attractive industry as others? That's something that we all need to work towards to encourage the youngsters that there is a really healthy career in construction. You know, it's changed massively since we first got into it, and certainly in our roles, it's become a lot more professional over the years, and you're able to influence a lot more aspects of construction than traditional quantity surveyors did in the late 80s.
Sure. So Gary, lack of certainty, skill shortage.
Yeah, I think there's a big issue with resource and quality of resource, and the infrastructure around being able to train resource, i.e. trades, you know, investment in the colleges. We're the biggest recruiter of electrical apprentices in the country, and we have a lot of relationships with local colleges, and there is a gap there in terms of being able to get proper training into the colleges to then bring through the tradespeople. So, and then if you've got a scarcity of resource, then prices are going to go up. It's going to be, you know, demand's not going anywhere. There's still lots of opportunity out there in various different sectors of the industry. Data centers is seeing a big increase in activity over the last few years, and it's set to continue. In the past, we've relied on bringing workers in from particularly Eastern Europe to fill the gap in the resources that normally would come from indigenous avenues.
Sure.
Brexit has put a stop on that. People are looking elsewhere, not necessarily the UK. So there's that. So, you know, some investment in the training and the in adult learning, because, you know, with AI and at the moment, I've not seen robots replace builders, for example. So I've seen some machines that can do various bits, but at the moment I've not seen anyone being able to replace someone installing in our business cables and pipes and welding and stuff. So
okay, yeah. So you yourselves as individuals have moved on from there. So you are now managers, you're leaders. Can you recall the moment, or perhaps a moment, like an aha moment at the risk of sounding like Alan Partridge, when you realised that the tech skills, the expertise that you had, all those things were something that you'd done previously, but they were no longer enough for what you wanted to do? You needed to develop your people, your social skills, to get on, to become those leaders that you are now. What was the catalyst? When was that?
I don't think, for me personally, there was a catalyst. It was a gradual transition from, and with that, it came from knowledge, experience, and opportunity, and being given greater responsibility. So, in our world, particularly as contracting surveyors, you go up through the ranks of trainee, assistant, QS, senior QS, manager, surveyor, and with those those grades, if you like, of opportunity, etc., you get an opportunity. And at some point you move away from just being looking after yourself to the responsibility gets greater. So you have to then start to delegate and trust in individuals who work for you. Now, from my experience, you've either got it or you haven't.
All right.
And there's certain things, soft skills you can teach, but if you cannot trust in others to do work for you, then you've got a limited capability scope to expand. I mean, I've gone from, when you're a senior QS, you might look after two surveyors on a project. Manager surveyor, you look after multiple projects and you look after more surveyors. So I've got a team now that's 50 strong. So that in itself, I've put the people in around me, and that's come through recruitment, being in the right place at the right time as well, because every now and again you'll be in a position to think, I need him or her, and it's like, I'm going to get those. And there's a bit of luck in that, but as soon as you build that team around you and you've got the trust of that team and they've got your back, then great things can happen.
How much of those social skills that Gary's talking about can be taught, Jonathan?
I think you can be shown the way.
Okay.
So it can be taught, but can it then be applied and do people really get it? That's the difference. In my opinion, to be a good leader, you have to manage your people very well. That's a number of things, from being effective and clear in your delegation, direction, but also being a good listener. Because it's two-way if you really want the best relationships. But, you know, the technical skills will get you so far. If you want to be a director of a big organisation, without those people skills, it's very, very hard to succeed. And it's very hard to call someone a manager if they're not managing people or not managing people effectively.
Okay. Well, you know,
people. That is what success in this industry is about.
And I'm a great advocate in sharing in that success. There's different types of leaders, but you know, if you can provide the opportunity in sharing of a success and bask in their success as well, not take it. You know, some leaders will actually dine out on their the labours of their.
Oh yes, we've all been there.
So,
but it's okay. So you're talking about, you've got into the nitty gritty here now about leadership, but part of leadership is resilience, is good communication. Now your industry is notorious for being prone to how do I put this, the occasional economic shock or worse. So can you describe a setback or maybe even a crisis and that and what that taught you about leadership?
I can name two. I can name two big shocks. There's the financial crisis, 2008. The construction industry lost a lot of talent out of the industry back at that time. And then if I move forward 12 years to COVID, dealing with COVID was sudden, and the uncertainty that came around at that point.
Well, what did it teach you?
To act decisively. Protect the business. You know, the business comes first, and you have to make decisions which ordinarily you would not like to make. I mean, we went round, so within the end of the first lockdown, we entered into a redundancy situation. And then there was the furlough scheme that the government brought out. So there was redundancy, who was going on furlough. You know, I remember asking the FD, how long have we got before there's no money left? Because at the time you didn't know.
What did Chia Hee say?
He gave us 8 months, which I thought, well, it's not too bad. It was just the uncertainty, because, I mean, Jonathan's mentioned uncertainty in other issues, but COVID was just,
Same for you, Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, what it did show is the resilience of the construction industry. Apart from a handful of weeks at the start, we had people on site 5-6 days a week on every project. you know, throughout. So there was careful working arrangements. There's extra cabins that had to be brought and extra cleaning and so on. But we made it work, and that showed the sort of the resilience that we had as an industry. But going one level down, there is shocks in the construction industry every day, insolvencies, but also the projects. The projects have a reasonable high risk element. And that is one of the things when you are managing a business, it's understanding the type of work that you're taking on, the risk profile, and very importantly, getting the culture such that if there's a problem, people shout out early because they feel safe to do so. Because if there's a problem on a job and you've got the chance to minimise or mitigate it or remove it, you know, it's worth a lot of money. If you don't and people put their head in the sand and think it will all go away, that is when you lose millions of pounds.
Okay, so when you have the shocks, that's when the culture kicks in.
Absolutely.
So on the other side of the coin, is there a time when you've leaned back in the chair and you've said, oh God, I love this. Right industry, right time, right job. Absolutely love it.
You can start with the little things like, and if Gary mentioned it earlier about the jobs that he's worked on, I can take the family in a car on holiday. And before I even get there, they go, yes, we know, Dad. We know you were involved in building that job.
This is the M40, is it? Oh, no, was it?
Yeah. So, you know, they're the little wins. But I would say the fact that construction is very much like a team sport. You're all in it together. You do work hard. You work long hours. But you work as a team. We are good at celebrating success. We probably learned that in the Gooseberry Bush around the corner. And we back each other when there's problems and we find a way through it. When you look at your career and the people you've grown up with, you know, they're like family. And that's the bit that I think is special from maybe other industries. And a message I'll say to the young people is, I know they want to bounce every 2 or 3 years to other jobs. When you stay in a business a long time, as long as it's the right business, the relationships you can form really helps you, I suppose, gives you the best chance of getting to the top, but also forming some powerful relationships that will see you through life.
So I was just going to say, Gary, I noticed that both of you have been in with the same company or the same group for quite some time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just echoing Jonathan, I mean, when I take the family into London, it's like the family will go, do you do that? Yes, yeah, I worked on that one. So, and there's in a team environment, which construction is, you get most projects don't last more than 2 years, and the team get very involved and focused on that job. And when it goes well, there's no better place to be. I mean, a lot of good leaders refer to a like a sporting environment, a football manager type thing. You can still like and how you win on all scales, and you know, winning at football or winning at rugby, and then how you get there, you can apply those same philosophy to a professional construction projects as well.
I remember when I was an editor, I used to always envisage, I was just think, what would Brian Clough do? Oh God, it was just exactly, I don't completely understand what you're talking about. Right, so finally, let's look back over your 30 years in construction. I'm sorry I keep aging you like this. So 3 decades, but you know, you were at the top.
Seems like yesterday we were here.
So if you could go back to the day you accepted your first senior leadership role, what is the one crucial piece of advice that you might give your younger self, Jonathan?
God, it's hard to break it down into one, but very quickly I'll say, you don't need to know it all. It's about asking who you can ask for that advice in certain aspects. And you can't fix everything quickly. It's about putting a sort of longer term plan, breaking it down to bite-sized chunks. So, you know, if you focus on 3 things to improve, you've got a chance of succeeding. You try and do 10 things, you crash and burn. But it's all about relationships.
Narrow it down. Choose your tasks, but it's all about relationships. Great stuff. Gary?
Be positive, inquisitive, and above all else, be critical and analyse your performance. Being a professional is all about that. And so like, how can I improve? How can I assess the outcome of your efforts and then see how I could improve that? Because you will come across the same situations again, albeit slightly different and slightly nuanced, but they will come back. And if you can critically assess how you performed, then apply that to the future, then you will get better and become more successful.
Great stuff. Reflect on what you've done. Love it. So, Jonathan Suckling, Gary Julian, thanks very, very much for sharing your insights with us on this episode of the Business Leaders Podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast with Jonathan Suckling and Gary Julian, why not listen to previous shows with construction leader Dan Mayer, MD of Via East Midlands and ARC Partnership Companies, Washington-based economist Dr. Jessica Louts from America's National Association of Realtors, Managing Director of Morgan Sindal, Sean Bowles, or Dubai-based developer Louise Rodriguez, owner of the Aquila Consultancy. This episode of the Nottingham Business School's Business Leaders Podcast was produced by Russell Bingley and presented by Mike Sassy.